The ruby red pilot light of the Fender Twin Reverb is glowing in the dark. It's time for this edition of Before the Sound Check, the program that offers you a look into the lives and careers of the people who make music happen. We talk up close and intimately with the artists, musicians, producers, engineers, the music teachers, the bus drivers, the production crews, the agents, and the managers. Everyone involved in making the music you love and who bring it to you. Before the Sound Check is sponsored by Thin Stroke Design, an award-winning communications and graphic design studio, and their new book, Love Letters, by internationally recognized typographer and illustrator Tony DiSpigna. The book highlights his classic American Spencerian-style font and lettering designs, the kind you can't do on a computer. That's Love Letters, available on Amazon.com. And now your host, Tony Sarno.
Thank you, Ronnie, and welcome, everybody. We have a real treat for those Allman Brothers fans out there today. Willie Perkins left the world of commercial bank auditing to jump headlong into the burgeoning beginnings of the Allman Brothers Band. His interest in the business of music and his association with an interesting pair of friends led him to the opportunity to go to work with the Allmans at the earliest stage of their career, and he was the tour manager for the Allman Brothers Band from 1970 to 1976. He went on to start Strike Force Management with Alex Hodges, managing Greg Allman and Stevie Ray Vaughan. Willie Perkins is now president of Republic Artist Management and Atlas Records. He holds a Bachelor of Business Administration degree from the University of Georgia, and he lives in Macon, Georgia. Willie Perkins, how you doing?
Hey, how you, Tony? Good to hear your voice again.
Yeah, it's been a while, man. It's been a while. So I read your book, No Saints, No Saviors, My Years with the Allman Brothers Band. And for those fans of the Allman Brothers, it's a must book. It's just the greatest book. And we'll be talking a little bit about that today. But just to kind of whet people's interest, can you take us back to the very beginning of your association with the Allman Brothers?
Well, it all came about through a friend of mine, Twiggs Linden, who I'd known for many years. He was in California looking for new vistas of his life, and he came across Little Richard, who was a Macon, Georgia resident, as was Twiggs. And Little Richard said, "I need a road manager." Twiggs said, "Well, what's a road manager?" But he went to work with Little Richard and actually was with Richard when Richard hired Jimi Hendrix, pre-Jimi Hendrix experience. And, of course, he became a little fatigued with Richard after a few jumps around the country, and he came back to Macon. But Macon was the home of Phil Walden Artists and Promotions and later Capricorn Records. At that time, Walden Artists was the biggest black booking agency in the country. I mean, they booked every soul band you'd ever, just about ever thought of the name of. And so Twiggs went on the road with Sam and Dave and Percy Sledge, Arthur Conley. I think he did European Stax Volt Review. So he worked with all those black bands. And then when Phil started the record label, Phil Walden started the record label Capricorn, Phil had heard about this great white session guitar player up in Muscle Shoals that was playing with Aretha and Wilson Pickett, just about all the Atlantic acts, and sent Twiggs up there to take a look at it. And of course, Twiggs came back raving about Duane Allman. And from there, the Allman Band was put together, and Twiggs was their road manager. Well, that's when I heard about the band. That's when I first saw them at Piedmont Park in Atlanta, where they'd play periodically free gigs, because they weren't playing many paid concerts at that point, because they just weren't well known. But I was healed musically that first time I saw him play live. And, of course, I've been a disciple ever since, and that's over 50 years now. But a terrible thing happened in Buffalo, New York. Twiggs had been working up for several days, was really fatigued, and got in an argument with a club owner because he didn't get paid. Was told to come back the next morning, which hardly ever happens in the music business. You rarely have to come back for money, or there's going to be a problem. And there was a problem the next morning. The Twigs and the club owner got in another argument, and a fight ensued, and the club owner got stabbed and died. And so I had told Twigs before how much I wanted to go to work for the band. He said, well, you know, there's just no money and there's no position. But he said, I promise you, if anything ever happens, you'll be the first person we hire. Well, I get a call from Butch Trucks, the drummer, saying that Twigs has happened. I knew about it because it was national news that road manager had killed a club owner in Buffalo, New York. So I was waiting for that call, hoping I would get it, and I got it from Butch, and he said, if you want to come to work, Twig says you're the guy that can handle this job. And I said, yeah, I want to give it a try. I was working at a bank, which is about as far from rock and roll as you can get.
Yeah, that's right.
And when I told my family and my boss and everybody what I was going to do, they thought I had completely lost my mind, which they were probably right. But I did it, and I look back, I have very few regrets.
Well, it sounds like music chose you, Willie, and that's one of the things that I call it, the guys that have been in it as long as I have, and my colleagues call us lifers. And when people say, well, how did you decide to go into music? It's the old cliche. Well, I didn't pick it. It picked me. And it sounds to me like that's kind of applies to you too.
Yeah, I kind of think so. It just seemed like that whole band, everything just seemed to line up, the stars and the moon and the planets and, all those great musicians from various backgrounds came together, and the music they played was a combination of rock and soul and country and blues and jazz, and everything just came together, and I was so glad to be a part of it. Of course, we went from playing $500 a night club gigs to hundreds of thousands of dollars per concert over the next few years.
And your banking experience came in handy there.
It did. I was able to put a little bit of order to the financial side of the picture, and of course logistics. That was Twig's specialty, and I kind of learned from his example. And you know, we had some bumpy roads, but I adapted to them pretty quickly, and they to me, and it worked out fine.
And Willie, you told me that the first song that you ever heard from the Allman Brothers was something called One More Ride. Is that correct?
That's correct. It was a demo they recorded when they all had moved up to Macon, Georgia, where Capricorn Studio was. And the actual song and the recording were never completed, and it never went on any of their early albums. Only when the 20th anniversary box set came out was it included. So it's on that box set.
So I went to look for that, and I did find it, Willie. Now I'm looking at the cover here, and all I see Butch, I see Dwayne, I see, who's the guy with the big long mutton chops? Who's that?
That's Barry Oakley, the bass player.
Okay, and then I see J-Mo, and I see Dickie, but I don't see Greg. Is he not in that picture?
He should be. I don't know. I'm not looking at what you're looking at, so I'm not really sure.
He called in sick that day, I guess. I don't know.
Well, Greg was actually the last person to join the band, so it's possible there's a picture there before he got there. You know, they had this big jam in Jacksonville. Dwayne and Greg had been in a band called Hourglass on the West Coast, and it was just a horrible experience. The band was giving them songs they didn't like, didn't know, and dressing them up in the, you know, the hippie costumes of the mid to late 60s. And Dwayne had gotten enough of that and came home. Greg was still out there. But when Dwayne was putting the Allman Brothers together, he thought he had everything he needed except the lead singer. And he actually had a keyboard player, but he wanted the his brother Greg to come in and play keyboards, Hammond organ specifically, and be the lead vocalist and songwriter. So once Greg got there, they had a jam there in Jacksonville. And when it was over, hours later, Dwayne stood in front of the door and said, anybody that wants out of this band is going to have to kick my ass and come through this door.
Now, Greg, how old would Greg have been at that time?
Oh, gosh, they were all babies. I look back on it now, and I was the senior citizen, and I was about 7 to 8 years, 9 years older than most of them. So they were in their very early 20s.
Greg, his singing, his voice, he sounds like he's lived a whole lifetime, and he was about, what, 21 or 20 or
yeah.
something?
And
it was just, I mean, I've never heard anything like that, and it's so from the heart. I think that's a lot of the music that we're getting these days. Well, I don't want to say that sound like there's no good music. There's still good music.
Yeah.
It was from the heart, and he really, really delivered those songs.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people say, you know, Greg's one of the greatest white blues singers of all time. Well, I say he was one of the greatest blues singer regarding of a race of all time.
Now, Willie, I'm going to play a little bit of that first song because I'd never heard it, and I want the folks to hear that song.
Yeah.
And we'll just play a little bit of it here.
Okay.
One More Ride by the Allman Brothers. Why don't you tell us what a road manager does? Because I know, because I've been out there a long time, and sometimes with my band, I have to act as road manager. And I'll tell you, that's a thankless job. But why don't you walk us through what a road manager actually does?
Well, the road manager is technically responsible for all logistics that enable the band to make it to the city, make it to the venue, play the gig, get paid, go back to the hotel, and repeat that for like 30, 45 days at a time on the road. Then you're also a psychiatrist, a babysitter, a truck driver. You know, you just really got to be a jack of all trades. But the key word is logistics. You know, people don't realize everything that goes into herding six independent-minded musicians around the country.
The hardest thing for me is when the band's sitting out in the van and I'm in there trying to get the hotel rooms, and
right.
it's just a nightmare.
It is, especially after you've been up, you know, driving all night, probably all day and all night, and everybody's tired and ornery and ready to get in their rack, and you know, you're in there trying to sort out keys and room numbers and making up a room and list so everybody will know where everybody is. And also, on reflection, what's always been a miracle to me is how we did all that stuff back in those days with no cell phones, no laptops. You know, your only communication was with the manager or the booking agent or the venue through payphones on the side of the road. But it got done.
We were playing down in, I think we were in Augusta. I can't remember where we were, but we were coming home about 5 a.m. And I was with my buddy Mike Ferranti, was our sound man and head of the crew. We had this old Jartran truck, and we're a mile from my house in Decatur. And all of a sudden, I see this wheel. We're in the left lane. This wheel go cruising by us in the center median there. And I said, Mike, somebody lost their wheel. And the guys in the van behind us said that we had a 30-foot plume of sparks shooting up from the back of our truck. I pulled over, and we were stuck, and I had it towed to the next gig we were playing. And did you have any of those mishaps like that, or was it pretty smooth?
It was a miracle that we didn't blow any gigs because we were sitting on the side of the road. We had our share of breakdowns. And in the beginning, the band had traveled in panel trucks. And when I came on board, they had graduated to a Winnebago camper. And they had an old Avis rent-a-truck retired from service, probably had 400,000 miles on it when they got it, and it was an old slant six Dodge, but that thing was bulletproof. It got us all over the country, and the Winnebago wasn't as, we weren't as lucky with the Winnebago, because those things are like vehicles to, you know, drive down to the beach or up to the lake campsite or something. They're not designed to be as a tour bus, which we graduated to later. But early on, we had our share of mechanical breakdowns. But again, never where we missed a gig because we broke down.
Well, we never miss a gig. That's one thing I always say, too. I've always lived by that.
Never miss a gig and never fail to get paid.
You got with them in what, 68 or what was
no,
it?
No, I actually first saw them perform in April of 69, one of those Piedmont Park gigs where they played free. And the incident with Twigs happened in April of 70. And when they finally got back down south, they played Georgia Tech there in Atlanta. And that's where Dwayne sat me down in the Winnebago and told me all the reasons why I shouldn't take the job.
Is that right?
And then, you know, he said, but Twig says you're the guy, and if you think you're up to it, you know, it's yours. So I said, yeah, I'll that was in late April, and I said, give me a couple of weeks to, you know, clean up my affairs here in Atlanta, and I'll join you. So my first gig was the first week of June. It was a high school graduation party down in St. Simon's Island.
I bet not many people know about that gig. I mean, people only see the Live at the Fillmore and things, and they never think they're playing. Right. I mean, you play parties and birthday parties. Now, Willie, were you at the Live at the Fillmore?
Oh yeah, I was there that whole weekend. And of course, that was magic time. The first two albums were really, to me, great musically, and but the band was into such extended jams, and you just really couldn't get it on, like, you know, 12 singles on an LP. That just wasn't what they were about. So everybody, the band, the management, all thought, well, if we can just capture the band live, that's what it's really about. If we can get that done, that'll be our ticket. And
it sure was.
Yeah, and of course the manager, Phil Walden, he was releasing the Capricorn product through Atlantic Records, and Atlantic didn't want to do it. They said, you know, you've had two albums that barely sold, and now you want to do a live greatest hits album. It's just not done. And of course, Phil gave them the sales talk that you know, we felt that was the way the band would break through with the public. And so they did a specially priced, of course, two LP set, two records for the price of one, and of course a couple of songs took up a side each. So I mean, it was like going to an Allman Brothers concert, and that has proved through time to be one, if not the greatest live rock album ever made.
We're going to play a little bit of that, Whipping Post, live at the Fillmore.
Right. And this is all live. There's no studio overdubs or fixes or anything. It's just all live music.
And Willie, I've been meaning to ask you: were you on that album cover with the crew?
Yeah, on the front of the album cover is a picture of the band sitting down in front of their road cases, and then the back cover is the same set, the same cases with the road crew in place of the band. And there's a picture on the wall there that's been edited in of Twiggs, who at that point had been in jail over his incident in Buffalo. Of course, he had been found not guilty by reason of insanity, which was probably an accurate verdict.
Wow.
He spent less than a year in a mental institution up there in Buffalo, New York, and then he was released, and eventually he came back to work for the band, but on the stage crew, not as the road manager.
And was that taken? I know you guys played the Capitol Theater in Portchester. That picture looks like it was taken next to the Capitol. Was that taken next to the Fillmore, or was it the Capitol?
No, that picture was actually taken in Macon, Georgia, in a little alleyway across from the Capricorn Studio.
Oh,
The original concept of that album cover was going to be the marquee of the Fillmore, with, of course, the Allman Brothers Band live up on the marquee, and the picture looked good, but it just didn't really have the feel to it that they were looking for. So the photographer came up with the idea. Well, let's just shoot it like it's at the alleyway behind the venue. Of course, we were long gone from the Fillmore, and we just set it up down there and make it.
You know the old cliche at the concert, someone will yell out Whipping Post. We'll be playing some place somewhere, and someone will either yell Whipping Post or Freebird. When did that thing start to happen?
Oh, that happened probably from the earliest beginnings. The band was always huge up in the Northeast. We played a lot of colleges up there, and of course, at that time they had what were called ballrooms. Every big town, Boston had the Boston Tea Party, Philly had the Electric Factory, and of course, New York had several venues, but Fillmore East was the biggest of the small venues. And so, you know, we had a huge following up there. A lot of people became aware of the band up north, actually, before they did down south. But you'd get those calls, you know, play all night, play whipping post, all that stuff. It became a kind of a cliche.
Did I read somewhere that it was the Grateful Dead that inspired the Allman Brothers to get into jamming? I read just recently where they got together to play, and the Dead said, "Well, let's just jam." And then I don't know if it was Greg or Dwayne said, "Well, we don't jam. We play songs or something." Does that sound right?
It could be right, but I don't think it's completely accurate, because I mean they went on extended jams from the get-go before they had numerous musical influences, and probably the Dead among them, but I mean from their whole first rehearsal where the band was formed was nothing but a elongated jam, so they were pretty used to jamming.
Well, that sounds like it might be an urban myth.
Yeah, there are a lot of them.
So, Willie, as I said before, I read your book, No Saints, No Saviors, My Years with the Allman Brothers Band. Where can people get that?
Okay, that book has been in print for quite a while, and you can still get it online at Amazon. You can get it online at Barnes & Noble or Barnes & Noble stores. But a lot of people like signed copies, so if you... reach out to me on a Facebook message, William Perkins, and there are a lot of them on there, but you'll figure out which one is me. And if you just send me a private message, I'll tell you how you can get a copy of the book personally signed and inscribed to you from me.
So the second book is the Allman Brothers Band Classic Memorabilia, 1969 to 76. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And is that the same deal? They can get that on Amazon?
Yeah, it's the same deal. The memorabilia book, as the title would indicate, is more or less a coffee table picture book. Has some text and some interesting commentary, but mostly it's photographs, it's some of the band's original equipment, guitars, amps, it's tickets, T-shirts, programs, posters. Got some of my old accounting pages in there. It's a whole gamut of the band, pictorially speaking. So the No Saints book is a narrative, and the other memorabilia book is more of a photo book.
Okay. So, Willie, we're just about out of time for this episode, but I think we're going to have you back on the next one, too. So, Willie Perkins, thanks so much for being with us, and we'll talk to you soon.
Okay, great, Tony.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. I'm Tony Sarno. Thanks for listening. I'd like to thank Ronnie Lake, Hippie Radio 94.5 in Nashville, and our sponsor, Thin Stroke Design, an award-winning communication and graphic design studio with their new book, Love Letters, by internationally recognized typographer and illustrator Tony DeSpina, available on Amazon.com. You can reach me on Facebook and Instagram at Tony Sarno Music and on my website, TonySarno.com. See you next time on Before the Soundcheck.